From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The White House gives a short-term emergency loan to Chrysler and General Motors, but there are strings attached. Will this keep the American auto business from going the way of the Model T? And can the Obama team keep its stimulus plan under $1 trillion? That was an unthinkable number even a month ago, but the game has changed. Author and economist Dr. Julianne Malveaux is here to give us her wisdom on the state of the economy. She's the president of Bennett College. Hi, Dr. Malveaux.
Hi, Farai. How are you?
I'm doing well. So the White House has decided on Friday to offer $17.4 billion in short-term loans to GM and Chrysler. This money is coming from TARP, which is the $700 billion or so on bailout. And so the President Bush, called it a chance for them to restructure. So explain to us what we're really talking about here.
Well, no money has exchanged hands yet. Basically, Chrysler and General Motors have the opportunity to get $13.4 billion by mid-January, but it means that they have to do some things. They've got to talk about reducing their debt, debt of $60 billion, reducing that. They've got to talk about cutting labor costs. That's going to be a bit difficult. They're going to have to enter into negotiations with the United Auto Workers about cutting those labor costs, which means cutting people's pay. Then if they're able to present something that is agreeable, they may get another $4 billion by February. Of course, this all comes out of the $350 billion that's already been authorized out of the $700 billion bailout. That money was being authorized in two parts, and the question that looms right now is whether or not Mr. Bush is going to ask for the second authorization now, or whether he's going to allow the Obama administration to come in and structure the second part of this bailout the way that they want to. So no money has exchanged hands, but even the possibility of money brightens the possibilities for these two auto companies who are struggling mightily. Part of the struggle, certainly poor planning on their part. Part of the struggle is a function of our own careening downward economy.
There are a lot of people who are working for the auto industry who are facing at least temporary layoffs, plans to shut down for the month of January. Do we have any sense if this money, if it's freed up, will be freed up in time to really allow people to continue getting a salary?
It is likely that some people will experience layoffs. The money will not be released before the beginning, if not the middle of January. I do think, obviously, Ford has bowed out saying that they're not in as bad shape as, let's say, GM or Chrysler. And I think that both GM and Chrysler do have some possibilities. So still, right now, the way that production works, people have to make decisions now about what's going to happen in January. And so, you know, people are even off for 2 weeks. For hourly employees, this could be a hardship, if not a crisis.
Now, President-elect Obama is going to be in the White House in March when he'll judge whether these companies have reorganized enough to be financially viable. So if the new administration doesn't like the plans, GM and Chrysler are going to have to pony up those billions and declare bankruptcy. What will happen if the auto companies fail to show that they're viable? And I don't mean what will happen to the auto companies, but what will happen to America, you think?
In the very short run, we'll see crisis. I mean, bankruptcy, people behave as if bankruptcy is the end of the world. In many ways, it's not. We have airlines who've been operating under bankruptcy for months, if not for years. Bankruptcy basically freezes everything and gives people an opportunity to reorganize. I mean, there are some who would say that GM, Chrysler, ought to go bankrupt so that they can reorganize to emerge more efficient. Obviously, the short-term casualties to a bankruptcy are the human beings, and so that's why we want to avoid bankruptcy at all costs. But it means that the auto companies are really being given just a small reprieve. They've got to hit the box running in terms of how they want to reorganize themselves. And what a lot of people are not seeing, and that's why they really faltered at the beginning for Rye, is that you didn't see the flexibility from them. I mean, first coming in with these jets, the three of them individually, showed just basically contempt for the kind of sacrifices that many Americans are trying to make. But even if we don't get stuck on the symbols, we have to get stuck on the substance of an industry that is producing too many brands of inefficient fuel cars, that took too long to get out of the SUV mode. And the questions that people are asking are, have you learned from the past?
Now let's turn to the Obama administration. They are putting together a stimulus plan, and they're hoping to keep the price tag under $1 trillion. That's trillion with a T. Do you think voters or lawmakers are going to say, hey, this is ridiculous, we can't do this?
voters and lawmakers have already authorized $700 billion for a bailout. And what we've seen already with $300 billion of that in play is that we haven't seen the economic conditions change dramatically. From my perspective, Barack Obama and his administration's challenge is going to be to do a bailout plan, a stimulus plan that's far-reaching enough that it really does kickstart the economy and gives us the opportunity to begin to re-examine economic fundamentals. If he chooses to tamp down on the price, to say less rather than more, the question is that going to be enough? We've got so many examples of attempting to be fiscally frugal in the short run, meaning a lack of stimulus in the long run. So $1 trillion is a lot of money, but we need at least 3 million more jobs in this economy. I'd say 5. I mean, he started out saying 2, and they've gone up to 3. Let's think outside the box for a change. What troubles me about the stimulus package, Farai, is that it looks very much like stimulus packages passed. And the people who believe in, are excited by Barack Obama, want to see him just think all the way outside the box. You know, not only the whole issue of employment, of course they're looking at health, but there's some different ways to look at health, I think. And education, I haven't heard very much said, although I know that there are some, like Congressman Clyburn, looking at education here, but what about putting education, especially higher education, into this? Now, we have seen school construction, but let's talk about higher education.
I actually got some information this morning that one of the leads at the KIPP Academies, which are a very successful chain of charter schools that work in a lot of disadvantaged communities, is going to join the administration working with Arne Duncan, the proposed new Secretary of Education. So I think that's actually a very interesting move, because the KIPP Academies are ones that are often touted by both conservatives and liberals as a really good educational model, one where they have longer days, they have music education, they had a special school open for children affected by Katrina who were living in Houston. So they're going to probably be some more bridge-building moves like that, but I don't know a lot of it has become public, as you've said.
No, and I think it's fine. I mean, one of the things that's happened is our economy is in such dire straits, and the current administration has not done what many have expected, and so the Obama administration may be facing unrealistic expectations. Without them even coming in yet, we're talking about legislation that hasn't even been drafted, and I think in some ways it's a little bit unfair. On the other hand, this is the burden that this incoming president has. He is presiding over a recessionary economy, at a time when, you know, tens if not hundreds of thousands of people are losing jobs and, you know, hundreds of thousands are in foreclosure. So you've got the perfect storm of economic unrest and these expectations being placed on his shoulders. There's a lot to do, but for me the bottom line is, let's not do it as usual. Let's do it unusual. Let's figure out ways to not only stimulate the economy but do it in a way that's fair.
Let's talk a little bit about money, that is the structure of financing and the Federal Reserve. The funds rate is now at a record low between 0% and 0.25%. What, if anything, has this done to jumpstart the economy?
It's done a little bit, but not a lot. We've seen interest rates go down. I think mortgage interest rate rates are at an all-time low. At the same time, I think that the only people who will be able to take advantage of that are those with excellent credit. And we know that there's a credit crunch and a credit crisis. So we're looking at a situation where those who are very well off, will be able to access money and credit at reasonable prices or much more reasonable prices than they've ever seen before. Banks lend to banks at about 3% more than that rate, than that 0 to 0.25 rate. And we did see some long-term rates or short-term rates go down. But if you have a credit card where the interest rate is 18.9%, believe me, they did not send you a letter that said your interest rate is going down to 16%.
This is the last time we're going to talk to you this year, 2008. Can you give us a quick economic forecast for 2009?
It's going to be a bad year. I encourage people to hold on to your cash, to be frugal. It is going to be a bad year. Still, we've not jump-started. We haven't figured out what to do about the economy. The unemployment rate might go up to as high as 8%. That would mean 16 to 17% for African-American people. That's 1 in 6 people without a job, not to mention the people who are dropping out of the labor market. I'm not optimistic about 2009 except for one or two things. I do think there are opportunities for activists to talk about the way this stimulus package might work and how we get economic justice along with economic stimulus. And I know that the American people are resilient people. We've had hard times before. This is nothing on the scale of a Great Depression. We've had much worse recessions before. So we will weather this. It'll be a tough year, belt tightening, and then we'll emerge from it, I think, with an economy that may be running a lot better than it was a year ago.
Do you think that we people, are going to change how we live?
I think some people are. You know, for I talk to people now about the holidays, and people are talking about less, talking about giving their children less, talking about borrowing less, and I think that's great. It's difficult to talk about permanent behavioral change, but I hope that people will use this economic dry spell to think about what their real blessings are. I'm talking to a friend this morning, and she says, we're going to have one meat instead of three meats at Christmas. And I said, and the blessing is that we have a meat. There are other people who are not going to be eating as well as we are. So this is a great time in the middle of this economic crisis to look at ourselves, to look at our habits, but also to count our blessings.
On that note, happy holidays to you.
And to you.
That was economist Dr. Julianne Malveaux. She's also the president of Bennett College. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. How much money would it cost you to buy the partridge in the pear tree or those five golden rings? Every year, investment group PNC Wealth Management calculates the cost in the 12 Days of Christmas song. This year, the full Yuletide would cost $90,000. Ouch. But what if you opted out of the consumer frenzy this season, and what if you kept it up for 12 months? That's what Judith Levine did. Then she wrote the book Not Buying It, My Year Without Shopping. Hi, Judith.
Hi.
Tis the season of excess. A lot of people are scaling back. Tell me a story of somebody you've heard who's making some changes.
Just about everybody I know is making some changes. Either they've lost their jobs, or they're worried that they might lose their jobs, or they know that they're getting less credit on their credit cards. And there's just a feeling in the air that it's time to be more cautious.
So why did you do what you did, and when did you start?
My partner Paul and I took a year off from buying anything but necessities in 2004, and I started just around now, 2003. It was the weather it is now in New York City, kind of slushy and cold, and I was walking around New York with a lot of shopping bags, and I dropped one in a puddle, and everything started to sludge out to the corner, and I thought, there has to be more to life than this. And I was also thinking about all of the other stuff that everybody else was buying, and where was it going to end up 6 months from now? Well, maybe in a landfill. So I thought maybe I could make some kind of connection between my own shopping habits, my own feelings about buying things and experiences, and these very big problems that we have of overconsumption, both personal problems about debt and global problems for our environment.
I've heard from other experts in economic sources that this may really help us environmentally. I don't want to go off on that too much, but what have you seen in your life? What changes overall?
Well, I certainly have made some personal changes in my relationship to shopping. Number one is I really don't buy on impulse anymore. And I always tell other people, if you want to shop less, buy less, wait. Wait 5 minutes if it's a small purchase, and wait 5 days if it's a big purchase. Usually, the impulse will pass, because so much of shopping is really an impulse. Another thing in my life is I save a lot more money. Therefore, I feel less anxious about the future, and I give a lot more away. I give probably 10 times as much away to political causes that I care about and charitable organizations and stuff like that. And I'm not really making any more money than I was before. So I've seen that I personally, and all of us, I think, collectively, can make decisions about where we put our money.
Can I ask how much you make?
I make about $50,000 a year before taxes, and I am self-employed, so I have to pay my own Social Security and my old health insurance out of that.
So when you think about your life, think about someone else who is not on your page yet, but is thinking about you know, radically, not just mildly, but radically changing their shopping habits. And this year they decide to do something very small for people in their life, and then they get a few bigger gifts that were like the ones they got last year. What about the feeling of guilt some people have, that they're just not, they're not on par by not giving as much?
Well, I think that's a real feeling to pay attention to, because gift giving is an important way that we show our love and that we glue our culture together. And one of the rules of gift giving is somebody gives you something, you should give them something back. But I can tell those people that people appreciate very much a small token, especially if you spent a little bit of time and a little bit of thought on it. What my partner and I do every year is we bake. We bake a lot of biscotti, and then we wrap them up looking nice, and we give them to our friends, and everyone is just as happy with that as they would be with a big gift. Now, we don't have children, and it is harder to do because kids want what everybody else has, but I think even kids can understand, especially if their parents are in tough straits and they live in the same world we do, and they understand that things are hard now.
Now, there's a saying from the Great Depression days, use it up, wear it out, make it do or do without. What are some of your favorite tips for doing those kinds of things?
Well, I am lucky to live with a man who can fix absolutely everything. But you can surely see if you can fix it first, and if you can't, you're no worse off than you were before. So take the toaster apart and see if there's a loose wire in it, let's say. Don't buy a new car. You know, if you want to be chic, you can dress from thrift stores, because those are actually chicer often than new clothes. Walk. Use public transportation. Use your car as little as you can. These are, you know, small things, but, you know, you said before, somebody who is about to make a radical change, and I would advise them not to make too radical a change, because all forms of abstinence, you know, dieting radically, or maybe even sexual abstinence, often you find yourself longing so much for the thing you're missing that you will really go overboard once you get off the wagon.
Where do you see America a year from now in terms of how people change their consumption and maybe their long-term attitudes?
You know, I'm not sure that we're going to have a great big attitude change. It's really too early to tell. Surely when people can get less credit, and if they have less jobs, they will be spending less. But, you know, it's not going to be like the last Great Depression, because the last Great Depression was not preceded by a half a century of consumer culture in which they really have brainwashed us to want to buy more and more and more things and throw them out and get the next new thing. But already people are changing their habits. And so I do think we may buy less, and we may start to think about buying things that are more durable, that can be fixed, that don't obsolesce so quickly. And we may begin to find, as my partner and I began to find, that you're really just as happy without it.
All right. Judith, thank you.
Thank you.
That was Judith Levine. She's the author of Not Buying It, My Year Without Shopping. She was in NPR's New York studios. No publicity is bad publicity, that's what some folks say, and thus the maker of the shoe thrown at President Bush is cashing in. And New York Governor David Patterson proposes an obesity tax on soft drinks. We've got these stories and more on today's Bloggers Roundtable with Kimberly Coleman, who blogs at sistergirlspeakup.blogspot.com. She's also a political commentator for Progressive Blend Radio, an online radio show. We've got Charles Robinson of Charles Black Politics blog and Liza Saboteur, publisher of the community blog Culture Kitchen. Hi, guys.
Hi. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. So Baden Model 271, that's the model of the Turkish-made shoe thrown at President Bush in Iraq. And the shoemaker now says his company has gotten 300,000 orders for the pair of the flying shoe. On the other hand, the Iraqi journalist who hurled his shoes at President Bush could face a prison term if convicted. He's charged with aggression against a foreign head of state during an official visit. Liza, what do you make of the two strains of this story? One,
It's funny because people are saying, or newspapers are reporting, that he's become a hero in the Middle East, and I think that he's become a hero worldwide. I just hope that the shoemaker you know, puts away some money for his legal defense fund because he really is going to need it. I mean, I heard today that he's suing the Iraqi security forces for them rough handling and, you know, he's claiming that he's been tortured as well. So it's I just think it's just brilliant. I mean, I am really it's such a powerful way to end the year for us because he has done what I feel that, you know, 100 million Americans have not done. And it's just to really, really show the man their how mad they are, how mad he is. So,
Charles, there's also the Iraqi prime minister. He's in a tough spot. There's been this outpouring of sympathy for the journalist, many people asking that he be freed. And if Nouri al-Maliki doesn't free the journalist, some people say he's going to be portrayed as an American puppet.
Right.
What message is it going to send, Charles, either way? Charles, let me go to you, Kimberly.
Uh-huh.
So what message do you think it's going to send either way if Nouri al-Maliki responds harshly or not harshly?
It's going to send a very strong message. If he does harshly, then it will seem like, as you said before, that he is a puppet. If he doesn't, then people are going to think that he was sympathetic to someone who threw a shoe at the president, which in my opinion was very disrespectful, and the gentleman who did it should be punished. So al-Maliki, the prime minister, considering it is election year for him, is in between a rock and a hard place.
But why punish him with a jail sentence? I mean, it is in a way an, you know, an expression of his freedom of speech, if there is such a thing in Iraq, right? That's allegedly why the Americans went there to begin with. So,
with freedom of speech, which freedom of speech comes responsibility. And to throw a shoe at a head of a state, regardless of if you like them or not, is disrespectful.
But
and
fine
it is the
him.
Ultimate
fine
form.
Him and, well, you know, and give him, you know, treat him as a misdemeanor, but not enough to have him tortured and imprisoned for years and years on end.
I don't think that he should be tortured or put in prison for years and years. I think that the punishment should fit the crime.
All
and
right.
Throwing a shoe at the president of the United States is disrespectful.
Okay, I'm going to step in here. I appreciate, I mean, you know that we love the difference of opinion. We just have so much to get to. And this is something that's much closer to home and could really transform people's lives potentially. I'm talking about the obesity tax proposal by New York Governor David Patterson. He wants to charge an 18% tax on non-diet sodas. It's going to apply to other sugary drinks containing less than 70% fruit juice. Now, he wrote in a commentary for CNN, the governor that is, that he hopes that the tax is going to curb childhood obesity.
Oh, God.
And that soft drink consumption is one of the main culprits. Liza, was that your oh, God?
Yes.
All right. Explain it. Explain
it. You know, the libertarian, and I have like this libertarian gene in me, and I feel that it is a complete cop-out to say that it's the fault of, you know, colas that we have an obesity problem in this country, especially among children, when, you know, the majority of public school children have no physical education hours whatsoever. I mean, they've been cut back so much that, you know, why don't we look at other ways in order to incentivize, you know, children to have the ability to move around and to play freely. Same with, you know, how about putting more money into parks so that we have parks open more, you know, longer. You know, I am shocked that he has come out with this. I mean, it is truly, truly, I don't want to use the word crass, but it's just not good public policy.
Well, Kimberly, let me toss this to you, and Liza, feel free to jump in. The price of cigarettes have increased over the years, and studies have shown that higher cigarette taxes and prices do curb smoking, especially in young people, in part because they just stop being able to afford them. So in that sense, our so-called sin taxes, and this obesity tax could be considered a sin tax, a good thing.
I agree with Liza on this. I don't think it is a good thing. I think that you're taking away personal responsibility from people. And from the articles that I've read about this, it's only going to be about 15 cents. So I don't think that it's going to make a major... I only drink diet soda. is one of the few things I probably do right. But if it goes up 15 cents, I'm still going to drink. I would still drink whatever it is I wanted to drink.
Absolutely.
So I agree with Liza on this. We need to look at. I was mentoring a child a few months back, and I was asking her about physical education. Of course, I'm in the Washington, D.C. area schools. And when she, okay. I don't have children. And when she told me that they didn't have any phys ed, mm-hmm. I was shocked.
Mm-hmm.
I had phys ed, you know, all throughout.
And not
school.
Just once a week either. It was two and three times a week. And if you
exactly.
were in a team, then you had, you know, two or three more times during the week. There's so many other ways of addressing this issue. And just to talk about, you know, less smoking among, you know, the younger generations, I mean, they're moving to other kinds of vices anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, they're using ecstasy, they're using meth, you know, there are, and, you know, the ever popular marijuana. So I really don't believe that taxing cigarettes really is going to curb addiction, which is basically, you know, what is at stake here. It's just you can't tax addiction.
Let me get
and
Charles.
Expect it to go away.
Charles, you know, when you think about whether or not this so-called obesity tax on sugary drinks is a sin tax, whether or not it's a public health intervention, we've got two votes that say no way. What's your vote?
Well, I think it does kind of curb this insatiable desire. In other words, we can have it all. And I think part of our society has said that, yeah, you can drink anything, do anything you want, and you, despite the ill effects that come along with it. If you think about it, you know, during our time, I'm assuming all of us a little bit older than we used to be, that we had an opportunity to not only run off whatever we ate or drank, but we had an opportunity to have somebody to kind of check us when we did things in excess. And I think part of it is that we are an excessive culture. You know, I think about my own kids. I've got to police them about being online so much. I said, look, you can spend about an hour, but you can't spend 3 hours. And that's part of where our culture is.
But in the end, do you think that there are public health interventions that work, that are tax-related or otherwise related?
I think the cigarette thing is a prime example of that. If look, right now I think the average tax on cigarettes are running around $3 to $4, okay? Well, those people who were kind of like weighing in whether or not they wanted to smoke or not, they looked at it as a financial issue. And that kind of curbed some of their insatiable desire to smoke more often. Obviously, it's an addiction, and it's going to take more than just a financial incentive to change people's habits, but it is the first step into kind of moving people in the right direction.
I disagree.
Okay, go for it.
I mean, you know, there's the chewing of tobacco also, and, you know, when I used to be a high school teacher, I would find kids chewing, and I was like, what is that, gum? And no, you know, they're chewing tobacco. I mean, there's ways, really, of getting around, you know, that. I think that, again, it's bad public policy when you're trying to tax, in this particular case, you know, a pattern of consumption, as opposed to really putting money where we need it in New York City in particular, where, you know, we don't have so many public areas are being taken over by real estate development. You know, money putting into creating more parks is non-existent nowadays. So, you know, there needs to be really more of a urban development planning of saying we're going to invest in our cities and in our urban, in our public areas.
So, Eliza, you know, on that note, guys, we have to go to a break, but it's a perfect place. We're going to come back with more of the Bloggers Roundtable, plus a look at a gentleman who just debuted at the Metropolitan Opera. We speak with bass baritone Eric Owens, one of the few African Americans in opera. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We're back with our Bloggers Roundtable, and today we've got Kimberly Coleman, who blogs at sistergirlspeaksup.blogspot.com, Charles Robinson of Charles Black Politics blog, and Liza Saboteur, publisher of the community blog Culture Kitchen. Welcome back. We could keep talking about soda, but I want to move on to whether or not a certain gentleman is black enough. I hate to even use that. I hate to even go there, but this is what's coming up. We're talking about Republican on Joseph Gow. He defeated Democrat William Jefferson, who is black, in Louisiana earlier this month, and he wants to join the Congressional Black Caucus. He is Vietnamese American. People are losing their minds. Charles, what do you think?
Well, you know, this is the proverbial, let me throw something in there and see if I can stir things up. Look, if Mr. Chow wants to join the Congressional Black Caucus, have at it. Just remind him that it is the Congressional Black Caucus and that the issues that they're going to be dealing with are going to be dealing with issues within the African-American community, which actually reach the broader communities. And I think part of this kind of let's see what we can do to stir things up has kind of produced this, what I call the drive-by white guy, the person who drives by the white neighborhood and says, oh, I can tell you what's going on there.
Oh my goodness, Liza, what do you think? I mean, some people are arguing. Look, there's a significant number of African Americans in Gow's district. Right. Why shouldn't he be in the CBC just based on that?
You know, I don't see why not. And I mean, we have to contend with, I guess, change in terms of, you know, identity politics being about the identity of the person and not necessarily of the people that you're representing. And, you know, let him sit in it. Yeah, I don't see why they shouldn't allow him in it. Of course, it's just exactly like Robinson was saying, that, you know, he needs to understand that this is about, you know, a caucus is about African-American issues. And if he needs, you know, needs to broaden it in order to, you know, also apply it to the rest of the constituency, then fine. But I don't see why it's not, you know, possible for them for him to be part of it. And actually, I think that there should be more inclusiveness in a lot of these you know, minority caucuses, where especially if you have white congressmen or women who have a huge population, either African American or Latino, for example. I think it's really important that they understand, you know, from our point of view, what are the things that we need in order for them to be better representatives of the people.
Kimberly, I'm going to switch you to another topic. There's an interesting discussion going on the Black Voices Community Board about who should not show up at Barack Obama's inauguration. The blogger is called Black Harlem Now, and her personal list ranges from folks like Karl Rove, who were anti-Obama, to former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick, Alan Keyes, you know, and all of the women from the reality show The Real Housewives of Atlanta. What do you think of the list, and do you have any additions?
Yeah, actually, I did have an addition. I had a few additions. I had a feeling you were going to ask me that question. I agree with all those aforementioned. I had Mike Tyson, Amy Winehouse, any of the women from Flavor of Love, Chance of Love, and A Real Chance of Love, or whatever that's called, and a few other people who I know from back home in Chicago.
That's so wrong. Charles, what about you?
I was going to say the girls next door, Hugh Hefner's girlfriend. Dad, please don't invite them girls here. No, you know, it's a lot of fun to look at it. I thought the Flavor Flav one, and then, of course, to add my favorite, I Love New York, you know, to that group, was kind of like, you know, what do you say when you get there? Oh, I'm just glad to be here.
And what would they wear, Liza?
Pretty much nothing, but that's a whole nother issue.
You know, I actually wrote about Flavor Flav once, that if, you know, MLK were alive, he would bust his cap. I mean, he just would tear on the guy.
God, but he's popular. I'm always amazed how popular
but
he is.
But it's like he took, you know, I mean, in Public Enemy, he was like a commentary about the minstrel, you know, culture. But now he is one, you know.
But we as don't Don need King would say, only in America. Only in America.
Well, that would be Don King then. Would you add Don King to the list?
Well, I think he would be. He's a Republican.
I think Don is coming. Let me just tell you that.
Oh, he probably is giving a party. He's probably giving a party.
Well, guys, are any of you going? Just quickly.
Yes, I'm going. I'm going to be there.
I haven't decided yet. I mean, I don't know. 2 million people in the same place kind of makes me nervous. And But at the same time, you know, I mean, it would be great to be able. But there's no place to stay. There's no. It's going to be.
I got a look. I got a sofa. You can crash on a sofa.
And oh, I, because cool. I live here, I will be here, and I'll be covering it for a radio station. So I'm excited about that.
All right. Awesome. Well, I just want to wish you guys happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
You too.
All right. Take care. We were talking with Kimberly Coleman, who blogs at sistergirlspeaksup.blogspot.com. She joined us from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. Charles Robinson of Charles Black Politics blog. He joined us from the studios of WEAA in Baltimore, Maryland. And Liza Saboteur, publisher of the community blog Culture Kitchen. She joined us from NPR studios in New York. If you're not an opera buff, you may not have heard of our next guest. Eric Owens. The rich, velvety tones of his bass baritone voice have made him a rising star in the opera ranks. He just made his debut at the Metropolitan Opera in October, and tonight he opens in the Met's most recent production of The Magic Flute by Mozart. He stopped by our New York studios to tell us about his latest endeavors. Eric, how are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm great. I'm going to have to stop myself from just listening to your voice. See? And you got a great laugh to match as well.
Funny. Thank you.
So tell me how and when you started to sing professionally.
My first professional engagement was back in 1993. At the Ashlawn Highland Festival in Charlottesville, Virginia. And it was a summer festival, and I found out about it because a man by the name of John Douglas, who was the director of the opera program at my undergrad at Temple University, he was in charge of this program, and he said I should audition, and I auditioned for it. And that was my first sort of paying, singing, operatic gig, as it were.
When did you think, it sounds, from what I know about you, like you've always loved music and opera, but when did you know that you wanted to be a part of this world?
Probably when I was about 19 or 20 years old. Up until that point, I'd been actually an instrumentalist. I played oboe professionally for years throughout high school, and I thought that's what I was going to do, but I'd been a lover of opera since I was about 11 years old. So, you know, when my voice kind of came into being and I started singing in the high school choir, the choir director there, you know, said that he heard something that might be worth pursuing. And I started taking voice lessons late in high school.
Well, let's move on to some of your professional successes. And there are many. A lot of people only dream of being on stage at a famous opera house like the Metropolitan Opera in New York or La Scala in Milan. And now you debuted at the Met this fall. Mm-hmm. What was that like?
It was pretty awesome. And it all didn't really hit me until the curtain came down after the first performance. Because up until then, I was just, you know, trying to rehearse and trying to work, you know, really hard and made sure that, you know, I was doing everything I needed to do. And even going out on stage the first time, it really didn't hit me because I was just trying to stay focused. But once the curtain came down and we were doing the curtain calls and I could actually see out into the house how many people were out there and you know, the whole occasion of it all didn't strike me until then. And boy, it was amazing because for any young American singer, that's the place you're shooting for. It's the pinnacle of the opera world, and it was great. I just thinking about it, sitting here right now, it was just, yeah, I'm really grateful to have had that experience.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the role that you were playing, General Leslie Groves in the opera Dr. Atomic by John Adams, and it's a modern opera about the countdown to the first test of the atomic bomb in the New Mexico desert during World War II. Let's start out by listening to you.
Sure.
This program has been played from the start by the presence of certain scientists of doubtful discretion and uncertain loyalty.
was agreed in Washington that nothing can be done about dismissing those men until after the bomb has actually been used.
So, what's going on at this point in the opera?
At this point, it's sort of a suspension of time, and the characters are on stage, and each one of them has these different thoughts going through their head as the night progresses, and everybody's sleep deprived and in this sort of dreamlike state, and so the characters end up thinking out loud in sort of these little short soliloquies, and all Groves can come up with is, you know, these darn scientists, boy, I can't wait to get rid of them because they've been plaguing me, and if, you know, we didn't need them for their expertise, they would have been out of here. And so he's sort of having this moment, and then following there's a moment with Oppenheimer where he's, you know, talking about memories, regrets, fears, spasms, afflictions, nightmares, rages, and neuroses, and he's sort of coming to grips with becoming the father of such mass destruction.
The father of the atomic bombs,
indeed,
some people call him.
Absolutely. And so the general sort of he has got tunnel vision. This project needs to get done. He's not having any sort of emotions about it or any regrets, or, you know, he just knows that the brass in Washington need to know that this is going to work.
What do you like about this character or playing this character? Who was white, by the way, and I want to
exactly.
ask you about that. You know, it's
absolutely,
like,
yeah,
it's that the whole question of cross-racial casting
right.
comes into play.
Indeed.
Or race-neutral, you know, some people call it.
And it's so funny because I was curious as to how people would react to me playing someone who was white and a character of the not-too-distant past. You know, there are people who are still alive who knew this man, and But John Adams, he wanted me to be in this opera, and he just thought it was character driven. He thought I could bring this character to life, and it did. It made no difference to him whatsoever, you know. And also the original director and the librettist, Peter Sellers, and they thought this was a story that affects all mankind. So, you know, whether I was black or white didn't matter to them, and so ultimately it didn't matter to me, and I was just happy to be a part of the production. Insofar as my feelings toward Leslie Groves as a person, it's a mix, because he could be a real bastard. You know, I spent most of the night in the opera just sort of screaming and yelling at people and worrying about deadlines, and so. But there was this one moment where he had this sort of human moment of talking about troubles he's been having with weight and his diet, and he meticulously writes down everything he eats, and he has control over all these men, but he can't get a grip on the whole dieting thing, which I can relate to because I'm a big guy. There was a sort of a tender moment. And I was glad that moment was in there, because originally it wasn't going to be a part of the opera, and so it gives him more dimensions than this just sort of this tyrannical militaristic guy who needed to get this project done.
On a different level, do you prefer, since you have a relationship with the composer John Adams, and you seem to be mutually respectful and also embracing of each other's talents, do you prefer working with someone who you know and who's working in the modern opera tradition, or do you like doing older operas as well?
I think it's 50-50. I like both. What's so exciting about working with a living composer is just that he's here, and if you have questions, you don't have to, you know, resort to some dusty old book. I mean, you can get it right there from the horse's mouth. But also, I mean, I just adore the classics, you know, singing.
Well, you're going to be singing Magic Flute. You're going to be
indeed.
At the Met again.
Right, I'm doing some Mozart, who I just adore singing his music. I'm a person, I'm an artist who just needs that variety. I need, a variety of different styles and periods of music.
What opera would you recommend someone to go see if they think they wouldn't like opera?
Wow. I would recommend them either actually going to see The Magic Flute or The Barber of Seville, two operas that have a lot of wonderful, fun, light characters, as well as some characters with some gravitas, but something like, either some Rossini or Mozart, so Magic Flute and Barber of Seville come to mind.
All right. Well, it's been great talking to you, and enjoy your enthusiasm for this world that a lot of us don't get to see much of.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was bass baritone Eric Owens. He debuts tonight in the role of Zoroastro at the Metropolitan Opera's latest production of The Magic Flute. He joined us from our NPR studios in New York City. That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, we investigate reports of Hurricane Katrina's hidden race war. I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes.